Section 2. The Production of Surplus Value. The product appropriated by the capitalist is a use value, as yarn, for example, or boots. But although boots are, in one sense, the basis of all social progress, and our capitalist is a decided progressist, yet he does not manufacture boots for their own sake. Use value is, by no means, the thing qu'on aime pour lui-même in the production of commodities. Use values are only produced by capitalists because, and insofar as, they are the material substratum, the depositories of exchange value. Our capitalist has two objects in view. In the first place, he wants to produce a use value that has a value in exchange, that is to say, an article destined to be sold, a commodity. And secondly, he desires to produce a commodity whose value shall be greater than the sum of the values of the commodities used in its production, that is, of the means of production and the labour power that he purchased with his good money in the open market. His aim is to produce not only a use value, but a commodity also. Not only use value, but value. Not only value, but at the same time, surplus value. It must be borne in mind that we are now dealing with the production of commodities, and that up to this point we have only considered one aspect of the process. Just as commodities are at the same time use values and values, so the process of producing them must be a labour process, and at the same time, a process of creating value. Footnote. As has been stated in a previous note, the English language has two different expressions for these two different aspects of labour. In the simple labour process, the process of producing use values, it is work. In the process of creating value, it is labour, taking the term in its strictly economic sense. Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. Let us now examine production as a creation of value. We know that the value of each commodity is determined by the quantity of labour expended on and materialised in it, by the working time necessary under given social conditions for its production. This rule also holds good in the case of the product that accrued to our capitalist as the result of the labour process carried on for him. Assuming this product to be 10 pounds of yarn, our first step is to calculate the quantity of labour realised in it. For spinning the yarn, raw material is required. Suppose in this case 10 pounds of cotton. We have no need at present to investigate the value of this cotton, for our capitalist has, we will assume, bought it at its full value, say of 10 shillings. In this price, the labour required for the production of the cotton is already expressed in terms of the average labour of society. We will further assume that the wear and tear of the spindle, which for our present purpose may represent all other instruments of labour employed, amounts to the value of 2 shillings. If, then, 24 hours labour or 2 working days are required to produce the quantity of gold represented by 12 shillings, we have here, to begin with, 2 days' labour already incorporated in the yarn. We must not let ourselves be misled by the circumstance that the cotton has taken a new shape, while the substance of the spindle has to a certain extent been used up. By the general law of value, if the value of 40 pounds of yarn equals the value of 40 pounds of cotton plus the value of a whole spindle, that is, if the same working time is required to produce the commodities on either side of this equation, then 10 pounds of yarn are an equivalent for 10 pounds of cotton, together with 1/4 of a spindle. In the case we are considering, the same working time is materialised in the 10 pounds of yarn on the one hand, and in the 10 pounds of cotton and the fraction of a spindle on the other. Therefore, whether value appears in cotton, in a spindle, or in yarn, makes no difference in the amount of that value. The spindle and cotton, instead of resting quietly side by side, join together in the process. Their forms are altered, and they are turned into yarn. But their value is no more affected by this fact than it would be if they had been simply exchanged for their equivalent in yarn. The labour required for the production of the cotton, the raw material of the yarn, is part of the labour necessary to produce the yarn, and is therefore contained in the yarn. The same applies to the labour embodied in the spindle, without whose wear and tear the cotton could not be spun. Hence, in determining the value of the yarn, or the labour time required for its production, all the special processes carried on at various times and in different places, which were necessary first to produce the cotton and the wasted portion of the spindle, and then with the cotton and spindle to spin the yarn, may together be looked on as different and successive phases of one and the same process. The whole of the labour in the yarn is past labour, and it is a matter of no importance that the operations necessary for the production of its constituent elements were carried on at times which, referred to the present, are more remote than the final operation of spinning. If a definite quantity of labour, say 30 days, is requisite to build a house, the total amount of labour incorporated in it is not altered by the fact that the work of the last day is done 29 days later than that of the first. Therefore, the labour contained in the raw material and the instruments of labour can be treated just as if it were labour expended in an earlier stage of the spinning process, before the labour of actual spinning commenced. The values of the means of production, that is, the cotton and the spindle, which values are expressed in the price of 12 shillings, are therefore constituent parts of the value of the yarn, or in other words, of the value of the product. Two conditions must nevertheless be fulfilled. First, the cotton and spindle must concur in the production of a use value. They must, in the present case, become yarn. Value is independent of the particular use value by which it is born, but it must be embodied in a use value of some kind. Secondly, the time occupied in the labour of production must not exceed the time really necessary under the given social conditions of the case. Therefore, if no more than 1 pound of cotton be requisite to spin 1 pound of yarn, care must be taken that no more than this weight of cotton is consumed in the production of 1 pound of yarn, and similarly with regard to the spindle. Though the capitalist have a hobby and use a gold instead of a steel spindle, yet the only labour that counts for anything in the value of the yarn is that which would be required to produce a steel spindle, because no more is necessary under the given social conditions. We now know what portion of the value of the yarn is owing to the cotton and the spindle. It amounts to 12 shillings, or the value of 2 days' work. The next point for our consideration is, what portion of the value of the yarn is added to the cotton by the labour of the spinner? We have now to consider this labour under a very different aspect from that which it had during the labour process. There, we viewed it solely as that particular kind of human activity which changes cotton into yarn. There, the more the labour was suited to the work, the better the yarn, other circumstances remaining the same. The labour of the spinner was then viewed as specifically different from other kinds of productive labour, different on the one hand in its special aim, viz. Spinning, different on the other hand in the special character of its operations, in the special nature of its means of production, and in the special use value of its product. For the operation of spinning, cotton and spindles are a necessity, but for making rifled cannon they would be of no use whatever. Here, on the contrary, where we consider the labour of the spinner only so far as it is value-creating, that is, a source of value, his labour differs in no respect from the labour of the man who bores cannon, or, what here more nearly concerns us, from the labour of the cotton planter and spindle maker incorporated in the means of production. It is solely by reason of this identity that cotton planting, spindle making, and spinning are capable of forming the component parts, differing only quantitatively from each other, of one whole, namely, the value of the yarn. Here we have nothing more to do with the quality, the nature, and the specific character of the labour, but merely with its quantity. And this simply requires to be calculated. We proceed upon the assumption that spinning is simple, unskilled labour, the average labour of a given state of society. Hereafter, we shall see that the contrary assumption would make no difference. When the labourer is at work, his labour constantly undergoes a transformation. From being motion, it becomes an object without motion. From being the labourer working, it becomes the thing produced. At the end of 1 hour's spinning, that act is represented by a definite quantity of yarn. In other words, a definite quantity of labour, namely that of 1 hour, has become embodied in the cotton. We say labour, that is, the expenditure of his vital force by the spinner, and not spinning labour, because the special work of spinning counts here only so far as it is the expenditure of labour power in general, and not in so far as it is the specific work of the spinner. In the process we are now considering, it is of extreme importance that no more time be consumed in the work of transforming the cotton into yarn than is necessary under the given social conditions. If, under normal, that is, average, social conditions of production, A pounds of cotton ought to be made into B pounds of yarn by 1 hour's labour, then a day's labour does not count as 12 hours' labour unless 12 A pounds of cotton have been made into 12 B pounds of yarn. For in the creation of value, the time that is socially necessary alone counts. Not only the labour, but also the raw material and the product, now appear in quite a new light, very different from that in which we viewed them in the labour process pure and simple. The raw material serves now merely as an absorbent of a definite quantity of labour. By this absorption, it is in fact changed into yarn, because it is spun, because labour power in the form of spinning is added to it. But the product, the yarn, is now nothing more than a measure of the labour absorbed by the cotton. If in 1 hour 1 2/3 pounds of cotton can be spun into 1 2/3 pounds of yarn, then 10 pounds of yarn indicate the absorption of 6 hours' labour. Definite quantities of product, these quantities being determined by experience, now represent nothing but definite quantities of labour, definite masses of crystallised labour time. They are nothing more than the materialisation of so many hours or so many days of social labour. We are here no more concerned about the facts that the labour is the specific work of spinning, that its subject is cotton and its product yarn, than we are about the fact that the subject itself is already a product, and therefore raw material. If the spinner, instead of spinning, were working in a coal mine, the subject of his labour, the coal, would be supplied by nature. Nevertheless, a definite quantity of extracted coal, 100 weight, for example, would represent a definite quantity of absorbed labour. We assumed, on the occasion of its sale that the value of a day's labour power is 3 shillings, and that 6 hours' labour is incorporated in that sum, and consequently that this amount of labour is requisite to produce the necessaries of life daily required on an average by the labourer. If now our spinner, by working for 1 hour, can convert 1 2/3 pounds of cotton into 1 2/3 pounds of yarn, footnote, these figures are quite arbitrary, end of footnote, it follows that in 6 hours he will convert 10 pounds of cotton into 10 pounds of yarn. Hence, during the spinning process, the cotton absorbs 6 hours' labour. The same quantity of labour is also embodied in a piece of gold of the value of 3 shillings. Consequently, by the mere labour of spinning, a value of 3 shillings is added to the cotton. Let us now consider the total value of the product, the 10 pounds of yarn. 2.5 days' labour has been embodied in it, of which 2 days were contained in the cotton and in the substance of the spindle worn away, and half a day was absorbed during the process of spinning. This 2.5 days' labour is also represented by a piece of gold to the value of 15 shillings. Hence, 15 shillings is an adequate price for the 10 pounds of yarn, or the price of 1 pound is 18 pence. Our capitalist stares in astonishment. The value of the product is exactly equal to the value of the capital advanced. The value so advanced has not expanded, no surplus value has been created, and consequently money has not been converted into capital. The price of the yarn is 15 shillings, and 15 shillings were spent in the open market upon the constituent elements of the product, or, what amounts to the same thing, upon the factors of the labour process. 10 shillings were paid for the cotton, 2 shillings for the substance of the spindle worn away, and 3 shillings for the labour power. The swollen value of the yarn is of no avail, for it is merely the sum of the values formerly existing in the cotton, the spindle, and the labour power. Out of such a simple addition of existing values, no surplus value can possibly arise. Footnote. This is the fundamental proposition on which is based the doctrine of the physiocrats as to the unproductiveness of all labour that is not agriculture. It is irrefutable for the orthodox economist. This method of adding to one particular object the value of a number of others, for example, adding the living costs of the weaver to the flax, of, as it were, heaping up various values in layers on top of one single value, has the result that this value grows to the same extent. The expression addition gives a very clear picture of the way in which the price of a manufactured product is formed. This price is only the sum of a number of values which have been consumed, and it is arrived at by adding them together. However, addition is not the same as multiplication. Mercier de la Rivière. End of footnote. These separate values are now all concentrated in one thing, but so they were also in the sum of 15 shillings before it was split up into 3 parts, by the purchase of the commodities. There is in reality nothing very strange in this result. The value of 1 pound of yarn being 18 pence, if our capitalist buys 10 pounds of yarn in the market, he must pay 15 shillings for them. It is clear that whether a man buys his house ready-built or gets it built for him, in neither case will the mode of acquisition increase the amount of money laid out on the house. Our capitalist, who is at home in his vulgar economy, exclaims, "Oh, but I advanced my money for the express purpose of making more money." The way to hell is paved with good intentions, and he might just as easily have intended to make money without producing at all. Footnote. Thus, from 1844 to 47, he withdrew part of his capital from productive employment in order to throw it away in railway speculations, and so also, during the American Civil War, he closed his factory, and turned his workpeople into the streets in order to gamble on the Liverpool Cotton Exchange. End of footnote. He threatens all sorts of things. He won't be caught napping again. In future, he will buy the commodities in the market instead of manufacturing them himself. But if all his brother capitalists were to do the same, where would he find his commodities? In the market. And his money he cannot eat. He tries persuasion. Consider my abstinence. I might have played ducks and drakes with the 15 shillings, but instead of that I consumed it productively and made yarn with it. Very well, and by way of reward he is now in possession of good yarn instead of a bad conscience. And as for playing the part of a miser, it would never do for him to relapse into such bad ways as that. We have seen before to what results such asceticism leads. Besides, where nothing is, the king has lost his rights. Whatever may be the merit of his abstinence, there is nothing wherewith specially to remunerate it, because the value of the product is merely the sum of the values of the commodities that were thrown into the process of production. Let him therefore console himself with the reflection that virtue is its own reward. But no, he becomes importunate. He says, "The yarn is of no use to me. I produced it for sale." In that case, let him sell it. Or, still better, let him for the future produce only things for satisfying his personal wants, a remedy that his physician McCulloch has already prescribed as infallible against an epidemic of overproduction. He now gets obstinate. Can the labourer, he asks, merely with his arms and legs, produce commodities out of nothing? Did I not supply him with the materials, by means of which and in which alone his labour could be embodied? And as the greater part of society consists of such ne'er-do-wells, have I not rendered society incalculable service by my instruments of production, my cotton and my spindle, and not only society, but the labourer also, whom in addition I have provided with the necessaries of life? And am I to be allowed nothing in return for all this service? Well, but has not the labourer rendered him the equivalent service of changing his cotton and spindle into yarn? Moreover, there is here no question of service. Footnote. Extol thyself, put on finery, and adorn thyself, but whoever takes more or better than he gives, that is usury, and is not service, but wrong done to his neighbour, as when one steals and robs. All is not service and benefit to a neighbour that is called service and benefit. For an adulteress and adulterer do one another great service and pleasure. A horseman does an incendiary a great service by helping him to rob on the highway and pillage land and houses. The papists do ours a great service in that they don't drown, burn, murder all of them, or let them all rot in prison, but let some live, and only drive them out, or take from them what they have. The devil himself does his servants inestimable service. To sum up, the world is full of great, excellent, and daily service and benefit. Martin Luther. Andi Fahian, wieder den Zwuchel zu predigen. Wittenberg, 1540. A service is nothing more than the useful effect of a use value, be it of a commodity, or be it of labour. Footnote. In Zur Kritik der politischen Ökonomie, I make the following remark on this point. It is not difficult to understand what service, the category service, must render to a class of economists like J. B. Say and F. Bastiat. End of footnote. But here we are dealing with exchange value. The capitalist paid to the labourer a value of 3 shillings, and the labourer gave him back an exact equivalent in the value of 3 shillings added by him to the cotton. He gave him value for value. Our friend, up to this time so purse-proud, suddenly assumes the modest demeanour of his own workman, and exclaims, "Have I myself not worked? Have I not performed the labour of superintendence and of overlooking the spinner? And does not this labour, too, create value?" His overlooker and his manager try to hide their smiles. Meanwhile, after a hearty laugh, he reassumes his usual mien. Though he chanted to us the whole creed of the economists, in reality, he says, he would not give a brass farthing for it. He leaves this and all such like subterfuges and juggling tricks to the professors of political economy who are paid for it. He himself is a practical man, and though he does not always consider what he says outside his business, yet in his business he knows what he is about. Let us examine the matter more closely. The value of a day's labour-power amounts to 3 shillings because, on our assumption, half a day's labour is embodied in that quantity of labour-power, that is, because the means of subsistence that are daily required for the production of labour-power cost half a day's labour. But the past labour that is embodied in the labour-power, and the living labour that it can call into action, the daily cost of maintaining it, and its daily expenditure in work, are 2 totally different things. The former determines the exchange value of the labour-power, the latter is its use-value. The fact that half a day's labour is necessary to keep the labourer alive during 24 hours does not in any way prevent him from working a whole day. Therefore, the value of labour-power and the value which that labour-power creates in the labour-process are 2 entirely different magnitudes, and this difference of the 2 values was what the capitalist had in view when he was purchasing the labour-power. The useful qualities that labour-power possesses, and by virtue of which it makes yarn or boots, were to him nothing more than a conditio sine qua non, for in order to create value, labour must be expended in a useful manner. What really influenced him was the specific use-value which this commodity possesses of being a source not only of value, but of more value than it has itself. This is the special service that the capitalist expects from labour-power, and in this transaction he acts in accordance with the eternal laws of the exchange of commodities. The seller of labour-power, like the seller of any other commodity, realises its exchange value and parts with its use-value. He cannot take the one without giving the other. The use-value of labour-power, or in other words, labour, belongs just as little to its seller as the use-value of oil after it has been sold belongs to the dealer who has sold it. The owner of the money has paid the value of a day's labour-power. His, therefore, is the use of it for a day. A day's labour belongs to him. The circumstance that on the one hand the daily sustenance of labour-power costs only half a day's labour, while on the other hand the very same labour-power can work during the whole day, that consequently the value which its use during one day creates is double what he pays for that use, this circumstance is, without doubt, a piece of good luck for the buyer, but by no means an injury to the seller. Our capitalist foresaw this state of things, and that was the cause of his laughter. The labourer therefore finds, in the workshop, the means of production necessary for working not only during 6 but during 12 hours. Just as during the 6 hours process our 10 pounds of cotton absorbed 6 hours labour and became 10 pounds of yarn, so now 20 pounds of cotton will absorb 12 hours labour and be changed into 20 pounds of yarn. Let us now examine the product of this prolonged process. There is now materialised in this 20 pounds of yarn the labour of 5 days, of which 4 days are due to the cotton and the lost steel of the spindle, the remaining day having been absorbed by the cotton during the spinning process. Expressed in gold, the labour of 5 days is 30 shillings. This is therefore the price of the 20 pounds of yarn, giving, as before, 18 pence as the price of a pound. But the sum of the values of the commodities that entered into the process amounts to 27 shillings. The value of the yarn is 30 shillings. Therefore the value of the product is 1/9 greater than the value advanced for its production. 27 shillings have been transformed into 30 shillings. A surplus value of 3 shillings has been created. The trick has at last succeeded. Money has been converted into capital. Every condition of the problem is satisfied, while the laws that regulate the exchange of commodities have been in no way violated. Equivalent has been exchanged for equivalent, for the capitalist as buyer paid for each commodity, for the cotton, the spindle, and the labour power, its full value. He then did what is done by every purchaser of commodities. He consumed their use value. The consumption of the labour power, which was also the process of producing commodities, resulted in 20 pounds of yarn, having a value of 30 shillings. The capitalist, formerly a buyer, now returns to market as a seller of commodities. He sells his yarn at 18 pence a pound, which is its exact value. Yet for all that, he withdraws 3 shillings more from circulation than he originally threw into it. This metamorphosis, this conversion of money into capital, takes place both within the sphere of circulation and also outside it. Within the circulation, because conditioned by the purchase of the labour power in the market. Outside the circulation, because what is done within it is only a stepping stone to the production of surplus value, a process which is entirely confined to the sphere of production. Thus, everything is for the best in the best of all possible worlds. Voltaire, Candide. By turning his money into commodities that serve as the material elements of a new product and as factors in the labour process, by incorporating living labour with their dead substance, the capitalist at the same time converts value, that is, past, materialised and dead labour, into capital, into value big with value, a live monster that is fruitful and multiplies. If we now compare the two processes of producing value and of creating surplus value, we see that the latter is nothing but the continuation of the former beyond a definite point. If on the one hand the process be not carried beyond the point where the value paid by the capitalist for the labour power is replaced by an exact equivalent, it is simply a process of producing value. If on the other hand it be continued beyond that point, it becomes a process of creating surplus value. If we proceed further and compare the process of producing value with the labour process, pure and simple, we find that the latter consists of the useful labour, the work, that produces use values. Here we contemplate the labour as producing a particular article. We view it under its qualitative aspect alone, with regard to its end and aim. But viewed as a value-creating process, the same labour process presents itself under its quantitative aspect alone. Here it is a question merely of the time occupied by the labourer in doing the work, of the period during which the labour power is usefully expended. Here the commodities that take part in the process do not count any longer as necessary adjuncts of labour power in the production of a definite, useful object. They count merely as depositories of so much absorbed or materialised labour. That labour, whether previously embodied in the means of production or incorporated in them for the first time during the process by the action of labour power, counts in either case only according to its duration. It amounts to so many hours or days, as the case may be. Moreover, only so much of the time spent in the production of any article is counted as is, under the given social conditions, necessary. The consequences of this are various. In the first place, it becomes necessary that the labour should be carried on under normal conditions. If a self-acting mule is the implement in general use for spinning, it would be absurd to supply the spinner with a distaff and spinning wheel. The cotton, too, must not be such rubbish as to cause extra waste in being worked, but must be of suitable quality. Otherwise the spinner would be found to spend more time in producing a pound of yarn than is socially necessary, in which case the excess of time would create neither value nor money. But whether the material factors of the process are of normal quality or not depends not upon the labourer, but entirely upon the capitalist. Then again, the labour power itself must be of average efficacy. In the trade in which it is being employed, it must possess the average skill, handiness, and quickness prevalent in that trade, and our capitalist took good care to buy labour power of such normal goodness. This power must be applied with the average amount of exertion and with the usual degree of intensity, and the capitalist is as careful to see that this is done as that his workmen are not idle for a single moment. He has bought the use of the labour power for a definite period, and he insists upon his rights. He has no intention of being robbed. Lastly, and for this purpose our friend has a penal code of his own, all wasteful consumption of raw material or instruments of labour is strictly forbidden, because what is so wasted represents labour superfluously expended, labour that does not count in the product or enter into its value. Footnote. This is one of the circumstances that makes production by slave labour such a costly process. The labourer here is, to use a striking expression of the ancients, distinguishable only as instrumentum vocale from an animal, as instrumentum semivocale, and from an implement as instrumentum mutum. But he himself takes care to let both beast and implement feel that he is none of them, but is a man. He convinces himself with immense satisfaction that he is a different being by treating the one unmercifully and damaging the other con amore. Hence the principle, universally applied in this method of production, only to employ the rudest and heaviest implements, and such as are difficult to damage owing to their sheer clumsiness. In the slave states bordering on the Gulf of Mexico, down to the date of the Civil War, ploughs constructed on old Chinese models, which turned up the soil like a hog or a mole instead of making furrows, were alone to be found. John Eliot Cairns, The Slave Power, London, 1862. In his Seaboard Slave States, Olmsted tells us, I am here shown tools that no man in his senses with us would allow a labourer, for whom he was paying wages, to be encumbered with, and the excessive weight and clumsiness of which, I would judge, would make work at least 10% greater than with those ordinarily used with us. And I am assured that, in the careless and clumsy way they must be used by the slaves, anything lighter or less rude could not be furnished them with good economy, and that such tools as we constantly give our labourers and find our profit in giving them would not last out a day in a Virginia cornfield, much lighter and more free from stones, though, it be than ours. So, too, when I ask why mules are so universally substituted for horses on the farm, the first reason given, and confessedly the most conclusive one, is that horses cannot bear the treatment that they always must get from negroes. Horses are always soon foundered or crippled by them, while mules will bear cudgelling, or lose a meal or two now and then, and not be materially injured, and they do not take cold or get sick, if neglected or overworked. but I do not need to go further than to the window of the room in which I am writing, to see at almost any time treatment of cattle that would ensure the immediate discharge of the driver by almost any farmer owning them in the north. End of footnote. We now see that the difference between labour, considered on the one hand as producing utilities, and on the other hand as creating value, a difference which, we discovered by our analysis of a commodity, resolves itself into a distinction between two aspects of the process of production. The process of production, considered on the one hand as the unity of the labour process and the process of creating value, is production of commodities. Considered on the other hand as the unity of the labour process and the process of producing surplus value, it is the capitalist process of production, or capitalist production of commodities. We stated previously that in the creation of surplus value, it does not in the least matter whether the labour appropriated by the capitalist be simple unskilled labour of average quality or more complicated skilled labour. All labour of a higher or more complicated character than average labour is expenditure of labour power of a more costly kind, labour power whose production has cost more time and labour, and which therefore has a higher value than unskilled or simple labour power. This power being higher value, its consumption is labour of a higher class, labour that creates in equal times proportionally higher values than unskilled labour does. Whatever difference in skill there may be between the labour of a spinner and that of a jeweller, the portion of his labour by which the jeweller merely replaces the value of his own labour power does not in any way differ in quality from the additional portion by which he creates surplus value. In the making of jewellery, just as in spinning, the surplus value results only from a quantitative excess of labour, from a lengthening out of one and the same labour process, in the one case of the process of making jewels, in the other of the process of making yarn. Footnote. The distinction between skilled and unskilled labour rests in part on pure illusion, or, to say the least, on distinctions that have long since ceased to be real, and that survive only by virtue of a traditional convention, in part on the helpless condition of some groups of the working class, a condition that prevents them from exacting equally with the rest the value of their labour power. Accidental circumstances here play so great a part that these two forms of labour sometimes change places. Where, for instance, the physique of the working class has deteriorated and is, relatively speaking, exhausted, which is the case in all countries with a well-developed capitalist production, the lower forms of labour, which demand great expenditure of muscle, are in general considered as skilled, compared with much more delicate forms of labour. The latter sink down to the level of unskilled labour. Take as an example the labour of a bricklayer, which in England occupies a much higher level than that of a damask weaver. Again, although the labour of a fustian cutter demands great bodily exertion, and is at the same time unhealthy, yet it counts only as unskilled labour. And then we must not forget that the so-called skilled labour does not occupy a large space in the field of national labour. Lang estimates that in England and Wales, the livelihood of 11,300,000 people depends on unskilled labour. If, from the total population of 18 million living at the time when he wrote, we deduct 1 million for the genteel population, and 1,500,000 for paupers, vagrants, criminals, prostitutes, etc., and 4,650,000 who compose the middle class, there remain that 11 million. But in his middle class he includes people that live on the interest of small investments, officials, men of letters, artists, schoolmasters, and the like. And in order to swell the number, he also includes in these 4,650,000 the better-paid portion of the factory operatives. The bricklayers, too, figure amongst them. S. Lang, National Distress, etc., London, 1844. The great class, who have nothing to give for food but ordinary labour, are the great bulk of the people. James Mill, Colony, Supplement to the Encyclopaedia Britannica, 1831. End of footnote. But on the other hand, in every process of creating value, the reduction of skilled labour to average social labour, for example, one day of skilled to 6 days of unskilled labour, is unavoidable. Footnote. Where reference is made to labour as a measure of value, it necessarily implies labour of one particular kind, the proportion which the other kind bear to it being easily ascertained. Outlines of Political Economy, 1832. End of footnote. We therefore save ourselves a superfluous operation, and simplify our analysis by the assumption that the labour of the workman employed by the capitalist is unskilled, average labour.